Welcome to the Trombone Retreat, podcast of the Third Coast Trombone Retreat. Today on the podcast, we hang out with Italian trombone soloist Peter Steiner. My name is Sebastian Vera, and I'm joined, as always, by Nick Schwartz. Pop quiz, Nick. What is different right now than normal?
Well, I am in the 412, the place of the terrible towel, the Yinzers. I am in Pittsburgh. Live and in person with my friend Sebastian Vera.
I'm looking at you in the eyes right now.
I see you.
You are not in my computer screen. I'm fully vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Very exciting. Well, welcome to Pittsburgh.
Thanks. One of my favorite places.
Got in late last night. We're recording right now, Friday morning. We're going to put it out right afterwards. We got Kiki, the dog, running around behind us. Life is good.
Yeah. I think Kiki just went in your room and tore something up, but so that's good.
We're not going to worry about it. we had a mini hiatus again. We had some family in town, but we're excited to bring this episode to you guys. But, you know, we're making a podcast, and we're trying our best to get it out every 2 weeks, but every now and then, it might not happen.
It's true.
We do what we want.
I got to say, it's very, very strange to see you eye to eye here doing this. It's like a meditation exercise.
I appreciate that we didn't put an episode out after a couple weeks, and we started to get emails about, like, is Nick okay?
Yeah.
They heard about him recovering from COVID. And
yeah, so I was I don't know, nervous, I guess, to receive an email like that. Like, uh-oh, like, I don't want to worry people. But at the same time, it was nice to have people concerned about my health. So thank you very much. I'm doing fine. Still dealing with some lung stuff. But besides that, I'm fully recovered.
We'd be curious to hear from people if any other trombone players that had COVID have experienced some of the same things. We'd love to talk about it and figure out maybe ways that have helped you to work on it. Yeah. If you had any breathing issues, because it's a unique thing that, you know, some people are dealing with right now. Speaking of unique thing that some people are dealing with, is we're still figuring out the retreat. We're still optimistic. There's tons of variables this year, as you can imagine. We're kind of looking at late summer if we're going to pull it off, and it may even be a smaller version, mm-hmm. but we're determined to figure something out.
Yes. Yeah. So stay tuned, as they say.
Stay tuned. So, man, awesome hang with Peter Steiner.
Yeah.
I think he's the youngest person we've ever interviewed.
Yes. Yes, he is.
But man, what a career so far.
I mean, unbelievable. He's done so much in, you know, since between the ages of 21 and now. I'm not exactly sure how old he is, but yeah, he's packed a lot into his early life, early musical life, I should say.
Probably given more recitals than the average trombonist gives in a lifetime.
Yeah, no kidding.
It was really cool to talk to him how he evolved from kind of being on this orchestral path to doing what he really loved and being a soloist, and how he adapted to being on the road almost 24/7 to being forced into quarantine. But he's really made it his own and used it as a time to, you know, reconnect with his creativity and get a lot of positive things done. And he seems like adapting really well with it. This episode is brought to you, as always, by Houghton Horns. Browse new and pre-owned instruments, mouthpieces, accessories, sheet music, and more at houghtonhorns.com.
And one thing that excites me about Houghton Horns right now that they're doing is they have build your own Tyner Shires trombones virtually at houghtonhorns.com. And also you could do in-person or virtual equipment consultation, so you can get fitted over the internet, you know, which has been our whole life right now. It's crazy that you can do that now. You can get fitted for a trombone online. So you can do that, or you can go to Houghton Horns if you're in the DFW area.
They have the Shires Joe Alessi model, the Brian Heck Lone Star bass currently in stock, free shipping, 15-day money-back guarantee. So visit them at houghtonhorns.com.
Enjoy the episode with Peter Steiner.
Hello, hello, hello.
That's some intense hair. I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah. you're just jealous, Sebastian.
Of course I am.
Well, jealous of your beard, Sebastian.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah.
I haven't seen myself without facial hair since, like, early college, so I'd be scared to see what it looks like. I think I would look like a 16-year-old balding man.
Ooh. So Peter meet Sebastian. Sebastian meet Peter.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. I think we've never met in person. I think we've exchanged messages a couple times, maybe.
Probably, yeah.
Nice to finally
yeah
put a face to a name.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully soon in person.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course.
So where are you?
I'm in Vienna, Austria.
Yeah. I've heard of that place.
Yeah. Well, it's not such a great place right now. Everything is shut down, so.
Is there a great place right now? I mean, anywhere?
Well, some places are opening up.
Yeah, that's
true. And getting vaccinated, so.
That's true. Yeah, I think this is probably during this pandemic, this is like the only time that the United States has been like leading the way because we're doing so well with vaccination, you know.
Kicking our butts big time.
I know. It's really strange. But hey,
well, good I hope for it you. Comes your way. I'm flying there in probably 3 weeks, so I'll probably get my shot there.
Are you really? Where are you going to be?
Probably just at the Bach factory trying out some horns before they ship.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You should be able to get it done.
Hopefully.
So how's the whole situation in Austria for those of us that aren't there? Are you pretty much locked down right now?
Yeah. We are absolute locked down pretty much until May 19th. Today announced that yesterday. Lockdown is a little different than what it was last year in March. Last year in March, everything was completely shut down, like nothing, no restaurants or nothing, everything shut down. Right now, like restaurants are operating, but just delivery. And then all shopping is closed. So just pharmacies open and grocery stores.
Wow.
So seeing friends is not really a...
No, seeing friends is forbidden after 10, I think 10 p.m. is the time. It's like you need to be at home. And I think 10 to 7 is the time frame. I'm not exactly sure. But you can't meet more than two other people, but they need to be closely related.
Wow.
And you can't leave the house. I mean, these are like all like rules, you know, like you can't see your parents. But yeah, so it's pretty freaky. Yeah, it's not great. Like in certain parts of town, you have to wear a mask, you know, like the crowded places. It's just a little uncomfortable.
Is like the U-Bahn open?
Yeah.
Okay.
Subway is running, yeah. But, yeah.
Nick just wanted to show off that he knew what your subway was called.
Yeah.
I've been to Vienna a lot. I love Vienna.
Just show off.
Yeah. A guy with a German last name who doesn't speak German. Yeah. Super show off. So you are Italian, but you are from the German speaking part of Italy.
Yeah. It's like right on the border to Austria. The place is called Tyrol. Mm-hmm. And we are South Tyrol, and then North Tyrol is already Austria. So we were kind of split with the border. So, but it's still Italy. I mean, looking at me and my name, people always seem a little bit confused why I'm Italian. But yes, it's part of Italy. I grew up there. I grew up bilingual, Italian and German. So yeah, that's where I grew up.
So it's Italy, but it must have a lot of German cultural influences in that area,
yes.
I'd imagine.
I think the coolest part about it is that there's all this variety, all this mix. Like you can get amazing pizza, but you can also get amazing German and Austrian dishes. So it's like it's kind of a nice mix in there. A lot of German influences and Austrian influences, of course. But like the town I grew up is about 70% Italian. So a lot of Italian as well.
Yes, it sounds a lot like where Daniela grew up in Slovenia. It's a very similar situation. Yeah, because it's like, you're like, oh, we have a lot of Italian food, and we have a lot of Austrian food, then we have our own little thing, you know?
Yeah.
Do you see it reflected in how the arts are consumed, or how the music people listen to? Do you see like kind of an amalgam?
I think musically belongs more to Austria. There's a lot of traditions. Yeah, traditional playing, I would say, is more influenced by Austria. So I think musically speaking, much more influenced by Austria, less Italy, because Italy is just having a little weird time with especially classical music. It's a lot of orchestras are shutting down, a lot of, you know, famous opera places shutting down, government not supporting orchestras, conservatories being really old and kind of not catching up or not keeping up with how the world is rolling everywhere else. So it's having a little issue, I would say, a little rough time. So that's why I think that the Austrian influence is much more prominent.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I hadn't thought about that actually before you asked that question, Sebastian, but
both places, obviously, with a super deep history in music. You know, I mean, you really can't go wrong. if you're like, okay, I'm going to focus on Austrian music, or I'm going to focus on Italian music. Come on, they're both amazing, you know.
Definitely, so, yeah. So really lucky to grow up there. I mean, all influences coming at one, even without wanting it, you know, just the offers come in, you know, you can listen to so many different types. That was really good.
Yeah, of course, of course. So when did you start playing the trombone then, and why the trombone?
I started playing when I was 6 years old. I have two big sisters. They're much older, 8 years and 11. And they both played instruments. One played the flute, one plays the saxophone. By now, they're both music teachers in those saxophone and flute. My dad used to play the tuba, and they all were part of the wind band scene there. My mom doesn't play anything, but she always was bringing me, so we were having our own fun together. So I grew up, you know, hearing all these wind band stuff all the time. It's a big wind band scene there, again, influenced by Austria. So it was just logical for me to play an instrument. My first love was for the drums, just because I, you know, liked something that was bearing everybody, you know, the loudness.
You have drummer hair now.
Yeah, you do have drummer hair. Drummer,
yeah, it's always my goal, being a rock star. Yeah. And my mom said no, and my dad, they were like, nah, that's just, you know, you can't do that.
And so you picked the next loudest instrument.
I did pick the next loudest. Yeah, that was a bass trombonist in the wind band of my hometown, and he was just so loud. He was just the way it should be, and I fell in love with it. And
thank you for saying that.
Yeah, that got me hooked.
When you first started playing, I mean, were you always playing, or were you just kind of just really into it, listening to music all the time, or was it kind of like a slow?
No, I was always into it. I was just in it from the first minute. It was just awesome. You know, in the beginning at age six, my arms weren't, of course, long enough, and it was probably hard for me to concentrate for a little longer than 10 minutes because I was really always hyperactive, kind of needed to move.
6 years old is when you started.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very good.
So it was quite hard probably for the teacher to get me, you know, to focus. But he was just amazing. We did so many breathing exercises, I remember. That was just, and we started with the mouthpiece, which was excellent. You know, by the time I could buzz and do everything on the mouthpiece, and we did so many breathing exercises, then when I got the trombone, it worked quite well. So that was really nice. And, you know, we started early with these ladder bags, breathing bags, and doing things like that. So from an early age on, I was really fortunate to have teachers that always put the focus onto the fundamentals and having a good breathing. And so that I was really lucky with the first teacher.
That's awesome. And who was this first teacher?
His name is Paul Pozzetta. He's just a local guy there, but has a lot of good students. So, yeah.
Cool. So I mean, that brings up an interesting point. I mean, if you're starting with someone that's just purely raw like that, it sounds like that's some of the best things you could do. Like, keep it simple. Let's focus on moving air, buzzing, making sure your embouchures are set up. And it just sets you up to like have a career of like not having to deal with issues. I mean,
yeah.
If you would do the same thing, is that the stuff that you would focus on?
Yeah. I actually have a 6-year-old student. I think by now he's 7, and we're doing exactly the same thing. He's just progressing much quicker than me. He's playing some crazy stuff already. Yeah, he's 7. We played the Weber Romance, and he wants to do the Gröndahl now, so he's like a killer. But I'm doing the exact same things. I'm doing breathing with him. I'm playing long tones with him. So, yeah, I would do the exact same thing.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Is it one of those things with I'm always fascinated by development and people that develop very quickly. And I think it's – do you think it's one of those things where with a kid like that, he doesn't know the Gröndahl is hard, right? You know, you just say, hey, here's some music.
Yeah. He's not afraid. That's great, you know. There's no limitation in his brain. I think oftentimes when it comes to playing, especially for us trombonists, we are always in such a box. You know, playing a piece by memory is something that even professionals freak out. I myself freak out, you know. So we are always in such a box as brass players. It's really nice to see a young kid that doesn't have these barriers in their mind already. You know, what's a high note? Like, you know, we all fear Bolero high B flat, but you know, he doesn't, because he doesn't know that it's hard. So that's really nice. Hmm.
Yeah. It reminds me of someone I went to school with who at their first audition did well, and like as a freshman. Mm-hmm. And it's just, they had never focused on auditions. And then there's something in an environment where auditions are everything. Audition.
Yeah.
And they were in the finals. And so everyone started saying, oh my God, no one makes the finals in their first audition. Mm-hmm. And then he didn't advance for like 6 or 7 more auditions, because suddenly he was like, oh wait, this is supposed to be hard. And this is supposed to be like difficult. And like, it's not to say it wasn't hard, but he just didn't put any pressure on it and just did it, you know? Yeah. And then suddenly he's putting all this pressure on it. And yeah, there's a lot to be said for that, the keeping it simple.
You
guys made him conscious.
Yeah.
It's like, whoops. It's such an example of like how powerful the mind is, right? Because the second you think it's hard, the second you think this note's supposed to be high, your body manifests that. So if you think it's supposed to be hard for you to advance an audition, your subconscious is so powerful, it's going to make what you believe happen.
Yeah.
So it's nice keeping the blinders on as much as you can.
Yeah, no kidding.
So you started school in Italy, in Bolzano?
Yeah.
Is that how you say it?
That's the city.
And that was that equivalent to like undergraduate?
But music school?
Like college, or is this like...
No, college I did in Austria first and then in the US. So college I never actually attended there. I did my, you know, elementary school, middle school, and high school there. The cool thing about Europe, when you're talented in music, you can already attend college. Like you guys have pre-college, but it's a little bit more than that. It's like a kind of talented course. So you can attend university and get lessons by the main teacher. So, and you can already attend a conservatory when you're still in high school. So you don't have to finish high school to attend a conservatory. So I got my first bachelor's when I was 16. Like I got to the conservatory when I was 12. Did 4 years, and then I got my first kind of bachelor undergrad degree when I was 16. And then I had to finish high school for 2 more years. But during those 2 years, my dad drove me back and forth between Bolzano and Salzburg, Austria. I went there once every 2 weeks for a lesson at the Mozarteum in Salzburg with studying with Dani Bonvin. He's the principal trombonist of the Munich Philharmonic. So that was amazing, you know, two intensive years of work with somebody that professional already during high school. That was just absolutely amazing.
That's awesome of dad for driving you so much.
Yeah, he retired right around that time. And he you know, he was a car mechanic, so he always loved to drive. So I think he enjoyed it too.
Do you feel like you got some, because I mean, to be a car mechanic, you have to have a pretty technical, analytical brain and be able to figure things out. I mean, do you think you picked up some of that?
No.
In regards to your playing? No.
No. Like, yeah, maybe in my playing subconsciously, but no, I'm absolutely like, if I have to do something with my hands, there's like, no, the outcome is not going to be pretty. So, so no, I didn't get that from him.
So then you did this for 2 years, every 2 weeks going to Salzburg. When did you, so you were 18 at this point and now you're taking auditions for college. Yeah. Where was it always, I want to go to school in New York, or what was the plan?
When I was 16, I believe I met, there was a summer masterclass similar to your retreat, was called the Italian Brass Week, where Joe was teaching. There were a couple spots, and I was too afraid to sign up because I was quite shy. And you know, Joe Alessi, his poster was on my bedroom everywhere. it's like I was really afraid of going there. And my sisters actually signed me up for it.
Wow,
really?
And I got a spot, yeah. And then I just had to go. And I mean, that was just crazy. That was a week, and there were major players, like major principal trombonists of good orchestras around the world, where they're studying with him. And then that was me. The first day everybody had to sign up for a certain spot. And I didn't sign up because I just took the one that was left blank. So I was, of course, the last one in the day playing. And I heard all the other guys playing Principle of Dead Orchestra, Principle of Dead Orchestra, playing all sorts of crazy stuff. And then it's like 6 p.m. I'm the last one. And he's like, yeah, now it's your turn. And my English was really bad back then. And I was just, I was dying out there. And
the what did you play for him?
I played the Gröndal, I remember. Gröndal first movement. And at the end, you know, we worked. First we did Bordoni number 3, and then we did the Gröndal. And we worked, and it was really, I enjoyed it. It was really hard, but that was just something that really worked. And then at the end of the lesson at 7 p.m., he said, everybody can go home except me. And I was like, oh, I was so worried. I was so worried he would send me home because I sucked compared to all the other guys. And then he said that, you know, if I would ever like to come and study with him at Juilliard, so that he would teach me and would be interested in having me there. So,
and how'd that feel?
Oh, man, you can see my face is still lighting up when I talk about this. It was just, I couldn't believe it. It was just amazing.
It's one of those moments in life.
Yeah. So then I was doing 2 years of the high school, going back and forth. And then when I was 18 and I had high school finished, I decided to audition for Juilliard. And that was pretty much the only other place I was interested in, except keep studying with Danny Bomber in Salzburg. So I just went to Juilliard and did that.
And how did you like being in New York?
Oh, man, it was a shock. It was like the first day audition week. I mean, I went with my parents, so it was kind of a vacation week. We didn't really expect any. I obviously didn't expect anything because I knew there were like 150 people auditioning and just one spot for an undergrad. So it was just a vacation week, nice week with my parents exploring New York. And then there was that one day where I played the audition. That was it. But I was shocked, you know. I loved it instantly. I was always looking kind of across the ocean. I just always liked it. Always liked
it. What did you love about it?
I don't know, everything. It's just there's something about the US that clicks with me, I guess. And yeah, I projected that onto New York, I guess.
As far as your playing and just music making, I mean, you grew up in such like a, you know, cultural hotbed of classical music, and then you come to New York City and study. I imagine there had to be some adjustments, or just like you noticed just things were different in the way people played. Like, what were the biggest things you noticed, and did you change anything about your playing?
Oh man, that was a big shock. The first time I heard the other guys play, I was shocked. I didn't know that there would be a way to catch up to how solid they all were. It was just, and now, you know, now I understand it, being around a little bit and seeing different places around the world. You know, the US is so based on practicing fundamentals that of course rock solid players are going to come out of that. And yes, we did a lot of scales here in with whomever I studied in all the times that I had changed teacher. Like, there was a big focus on scales, especially with Danny. He was a big scale guy. But besides that, you know, we didn't do arbans. It wasn't as rock solid and as figured out and as well taught also in Europe. So I think that was the biggest change I had to do. You know, I had to really dig deep into all these, just being able to play, replicate two notes. That was so hard for me. You know, I could play, in my first lesson, I showed up with a Tomasi on the stand. I could play stuff like that, but I couldn't play it to my satisfaction of being all round. You know, it was musically good, but there were always so many things happening that bothered me. And I think with the teaching style of Joe and with the focus on the fundamentals, I could figure out technical ways to achieve what I wanted to make musically happen.
So you were in school and then an opportunity arose to go out to Colorado.
Yeah. Second year of Juilliard, I think it was May 14th. A couple months before, Joe told me, yeah, there is a position opening up as principal trombonist of the Colorado Symphony Orchestra, and I think you're ready to take auditions. We have done a lot of work on ITA competitions before in that year. So the second year, first year, we really focused on basics. It was just really brutal on basics, a lot of arbans, a lot of Bordoni. And then second year, we did a lot of ITA. We did 3 competitions, and I got to the finals in all 3 of them. And it was really heavily focused on refining and on executing, because in those competitions you have to play from top to bottom. So I think around January, February, he felt that it would be a good time to start auditioning. That was also the first time he kind of called me in to play with him. There was a charity concert in New York with players of the Met and the New York Philharmonic at Carnegie Hall, and we played Shostakovich 7, and he had me as his associate. So I think like around that time, he felt, okay, now it's ready to go for auditions. And so I just signed up for the audition, and we prepared 3 months intensively on that repertoire. And I flew there. I honestly have to say I didn't know where Colorado was or where Denver was. I really have to admit that. And I actually got out the plane and it was snowing.
Oh, wow.
So I was kind of in shock. At the same time, I saw the mountains and my face brightened up. And then the next shock came when I smelled weed everywhere. So it was just, it was a crazy, crazy experience getting out of that plane, I have to say.
I mean, it's incredible getting to Denver, because it's just, the sky is gigantic. It's just you can see so far. It's just incredibly beautiful, right?
Yeah.
Now, how did you feel about the elevation, like as far as playing? How long did you have before you had to audition and stuff?
I never heard about that issue before in my life, before I came to the US. So I didn't even, you know, people were asking me after the audition, oh, how did it feel? And I was like, why would it feel any different? So I think that's, again, some mental block we have created.
Cool.
Because, you know, I grew up in the mountains. I grew up in the Alps.
Oh, see. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that might explain why.
Yeah. But that yeah, for someone who's from a low place, going up there does make a difference. But I mean, again, it shouldn't be like the biggest block in the world.
Yeah, I mean, your heartbeat rate also makes a difference. You know, we can make everything harder than it is, I would say.
Of course, yeah.
So I didn't that didn't really bother me. So I got the chance. I went there. I had to go through all the rounds, obviously, because I was a student and they didn't know me. Played the first round in the morning. I was the last number. I was candidate number 37. Played my first round, was the only one advancing out of it. And then there were, I think, 4 people that they auto-advanced to semis. Fun fact, I went to Chipotle between every round because Chipotle was my favorite thing.
Always a good decision.
Yeah, so I had the burrito after prelims and then went back to semis. Played my semis. 2 people advanced out of that. Went back to Chipotle, got another burrito, came back and played my finals, and they awarded me a 1-year contract because I was 21. So they felt that, yeah, it was just too young to get a...
Now going through this process, I mean, being a young person, I imagine it's one of your first auditions. Like,
yeah.
Did you know enough to be nervous? Or were you just like,
oh, yes, I was really nervous. You know, I went through all the hard schooling at Juilliard. Like, trust me, I caught up with all the fears every other player has as soon as I got there. So I remember the day before the audition, we had a trombone choir concert in this church right next to the Met. What is it? St. John's or something like that? The huge chapel.
The St. John's.
Oh, I was at that concert. Not St. John's, but St. Peter's.
Yeah, and I played pretty much first on the entire program because I just had good high chops. And I remember at intermission, we were all standing together and Joe came there and he pulled me aside from everybody and he absolutely ripped me apart.
just what you wanted.
And yeah, the next day was the audition, and then afterwards...
What was he upset about?
I really do not remember. It was just so shocking. And I talked to him afterwards about it, and he just said, I knew that's exactly what you needed to hear. I need to ground you because you always get over your head. And yeah, it just worked. He knows how to push my buttons.
Well, it sounds like, you know, it sounds like you came to Juilliard and you had a lot of talent. And you could do a lot of things, and you could play these solos and everything. And it sounds like, based on what you're describing, that, you know, I like to talk about ceiling and floor a lot, kind of like more a sports reference. But it sounds like you always kind of had a high ceiling, but the consistency wasn't as much as you wanted at that point in your life, and what you know, that experience at Juilliard may have provided was just getting that foundation of technique and structure so that your baseline was a little bit higher each time.
Yeah, definitely. That was, yeah, it just helped me to make happen what I wanted to express with the right technical background and being comfortable on the horn.
God forbid, be comfortable on the horn.
Yeah. What's that like? So you were in Colorado for 1 year, right?
Yeah.
And then you went back to Juilliard, is that right?
And I came back, yeah. I kept getting lessons from Joe all the time. So I flew back, if possible, twice a month, otherwise once a month, just for lessons with him on my free day. Normally Monday was always free. I always flew to New York and just, you know, kept working with Joe. So it was just the natural decision to come back and keep studying, keep refining, and keep tweaking.
So then you'll fast forward to your end of the time at Juilliard, and you get an opportunity to go play with a little known orchestra called the Vienna Philharmonic. How did that experience, how did that fall on your lap, or did you audition for it? How did all this come to be?
So when I went back then from Colorado to New York, during that summer, I had the opportunity to sub in with the Vienna Philharmonic. They had had a lot of auditions in the search for a principal trombone since Ian Bousfield left. I think they had already 4 or 5 auditions, and at that point they were just exploring different players, and somehow they came across me. I think he was somehow obviously and of course related to Joe. Mm-hmm. And they invited me to play Bruckner 8 with them at the Salzburg Festival with Bernhard Haitink, and it was just mind-blowing. So that was kind of how the relationship got started. And then I did, you know, I went back to Juilliard, and in January, you know, after 3 months being back in New York, in January, there was the audition, January 17th. I remember that date was circled big time in my calendar. And yeah, there was the audition for principal trombone. And for some reason, I got a word, 1 year contract. Everything went pretty well in the audition. And then I got the chance for 1 year to play with one of the best ensembles around the world. So that was really kind of neat.
Of course, yeah.
And that schedule's no joke. I remember Ian Bousfield talking about it in a masterclass. It's just, you're going back and forth between the opera and the symphony. It's like almost every day of the week.
Yeah, you play every day pretty much in the opera. Of course, trailing off with the other player that has your position. You always share position because there's so many services that there's 2 full trombone sections. For trumpets, there's actually 3 sections. Horns, also 3 sections. So you constantly rotate. And then in addition to that, you play with the Philharmonic. You know, the other thing is with the Vienna State Opera, which is your main employee. And then the Vienna Philharmonic is kind of your side gig.
Wow, nice.
They're not an employee, it's community. And like a society, I guess you would call it. And with those, you play like a regular symphony orchestra. You play your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday shows also on a weekly basis. So yeah, it's a pretty busy job, but coming from Juilliard and studying with whom I studied, it wasn't really a change of pace. It was just continuing the pace. I still, you know, even though I can remember one day I played Bruckner 8 in the morning and I played some opera at night, I think Siegfried or so. And in the afternoon, I still practiced because, you know, that was just what I was used from Joe and from my time being at Juilliard.
Yeah, just the opera and ballet side of that job. I mean, that's enough to keep you busy. And then you have to go play with a little band across town.
Well, especially musically, learning all the pieces. That was the trickiest part. You know, learning all these operas. Learning operas is so much harder than any, you know, symphony. There's a symphony is planned out pretty much. Yes, conductors do different things. Yes, orchestras interpret them a little bit slightly different. But an opera, it's hard to calculate an opera. They're every time a little bit different. And there's different singers, different conductors. So there's always the unexpected in there. Hard to really prepare operas, especially when it's a long one. And yeah, you know, preparation for Götterdämmerung, a piece that's 6 hours long, you know, it takes you a long time to figure that piece out, where your entrance happens and things like that becomes suddenly really tricky.
And from what I understand, the opera doesn't really rehearse very much. The orchestra doesn't rehearse. Like
pretty much you just rehearse when there is actually a premiere happening, which is like, I would say 10 times a year or even less, 6-7 times a year. But other than that, everything is pretty much no rehearsal. And, I played the entire Ring on principle pretty much, I think. Yeah. Without rehearsal.
That's crazy.
It's really sight readable, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the Ring was kind of easy comparing it to Strauss or Bohème. Oh my goodness. There's some rough stuff in there.
Bohème, there's not much to do, but every now and then
touchy moments.
Yeah. It's just like catching your entrance. That's the hardest part about opera, is catching the entrance. Because sometimes you're not going to get any cue, and you have no cue in your part except for a line from the vocal score, and that's it, you know.
So you're playing with, you know, it's one of the most historical music institutions that we have on the planet, right? So you talk about orchestras having like an identity and having tradition and having the way they play things. Going into that environment, was there moments where it's just like, you know, this is how we do things, and you kind of have to adjust?
It was just a real big shock. It was, you know, being on stage with so many amazing musicians. It's inspiring on one side, but then you always kind of put a lot of pressure onto yourself that you want to not kind of let them down, and also be at their level, which is really hard to reach really quick, because they've done it so often, they've done it so well for so long, that it's definitely a big step to get up there. And but it was just really, really inspiring. I sat so often on stage just listening. You know, as a trombonist, you get to listen a lot, which normally is not my favorite aspect of life. But, you know, listening to that string section was just a real joy. Listening to those French horns, or Viennese horns, actually, what they play here, that was just really neat. So I enjoyed that as well. But it was just, overall, it was just really inspiring, a real, real good time.
Yeah, I mean, that's one really unique aspect. I mean, I think for some of our listeners, they might not know this. I mean, there really aren't, I can't think of other orchestras where they have specific instruments, like not every single instrument around the orchestra, but you have, you know, specific like type of oboe.
Yeah,
timpani. Oboe. Yeah, they use the hand crank timpanis, and the oboe and the Viennese horn, which is crazy. If you've never seen it, you should look it up and then listen to the Vienna horns made album 20 years ago or something like that, playing movie stuff Back to the Future.
Ridiculous.
And amazing playing. And those things are so freaking hard. I mean, the horn is hard enough, and then you have that thing that's even harder.
Yeah, it's almost like a natural horn. It's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was definitely inspiring, and it definitely is one of the things that brought me to do what I'm doing now.
Cool. I mean, that's the type of orchestra that, you know, people are passing down their season tickets in their wills. People are showing up with scores. There's some like serious fans, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's really cool. You feel like a rock star a little bit. Like when you go on tour in Japan, or even after the opera in Vienna, there's always a crowd waiting for the artists to come out. It's cool. It's really, I mean, it's a dream. It's every musician dreams of it. And I had the chance to do that, you know, when I was 23, it was just, every day was just really, really cool.
Wow.
That's awesome. So what I would really love to talk about is what you did afterwards. And especially this year, the 2018, 2019, when you're just like, you know what, I'm just going to travel around the world. I'm going to play everywhere. It looks like you had a 3-month tour of the United States, Europe, Asia, South America. And I first started to see you, because I was just like, oh, Peter Steiner's giving another masterclass. Peter Steiner's giving another masterclass in a recital at this university. And I respected it, because, you know, you were getting out there and you were performing. And it's something that, you know, so many trombonists sometimes just don't get out there and perform, especially to be brave enough to put a recital on like every night. I mean, how was this experience for you?
Well, as I said before, all my days were really, really cool, but I wasn't happy. I wasn't doing what I love doing. And since that, you know, I made the decision to do what I'm doing now, and I'm just so much happier, and then I'm exactly doing what I want to do. I'm soloing all over the world, and getting to meet so many cool people. And yes, as you mentioned, that year 2018, it seems really crazy to play so often. But again, I just continued what I did with the Vienna Philharmonic before. We played a show every night, so there wasn't a doubt in my mind that a recital every night would work out as well. So it was just, again, you know, coming from Joe being intense, then going to the Vienna Philharmonic, which is intense, then just keeping doing that wasn't, you know, now looking back at it, I think it was a bit crazy. But back then it was just like, okay, let's just do it. And, you know, I contacted so many people that I had the chance to play at all these places, and that's how I got my name out there. So it was just fun. You know, I'd never really, especially when it comes to solo playing, I never really see a risk in it, except when you get judged like at the competition. But other than that, it's like you can really express yourself. You can do, you know, if you enjoy it, you do what you enjoy doing, what you're passionate about. And that's, yes, you know, occasionally the high F in Errors of Time as the last piece in the recital was a, you know, was a little fight through that. But overall, it was just, yeah, just what I loved doing. So I never really got burned out about it, or it was just cool. Changing recital program, you know, then meeting Constanze that is playing with me, my girlfriend, traveling around the globe with her. It just makes everything so cool. I mean, living my dream life, having my girlfriend with me, traveling, playing all the time. Since she's also an organist, we play, you know, organ recitals, then piano recitals. Then I get to play with wind bands. I get to play with orchestras. It's just a dream.
Now, the question I have is, were you ever like a nervous performer when it comes to recitals, or did you always feel confident?
No. I was really nervous before coming to Juilliard. So I'd never done a recital before my first recital when I got the job in Colorado. Before that, I never did recitals. As you know, Nick, at Juilliard, you don't need to do recitals before your fourth year. So I wasn't forced to do a recital before that. In Salzburg, I never did the recital. I always just played one piece or so. And when I soloed, I soloed quite a bit in my early years when I was 14, 15, 16. I played a lot with solos with wind bands and stuff. And I always just played the T-bone or something like that, just 20 minutes. But the recital is an absolute different monster. So I was really, really worried. And then when I went to Juilliard, the focus was all on excerpts. We barely did any solo playing. So that made it even more nervous for me to play recitals. So no, I was really, really nervous for recitals. And I think what really helped me is that I had good guides, you know, with my first recital, as I mentioned, was actually not at Juilliard. My first recital was while I had the job in the Colorado Symphony Orchestra. I put on three recitals at three universities in Colorado at the end of my season there. And during the entire time in Colorado, I worked with Warren Deck, who is a former principal tuba of the New York Philharmonic. And that connection started because I called Joe after the audition in Colorado and said, I got the 1 year contract. What do I do? You know, I wasn't sure what to do. And he said, take the job and call up this guy I'll send you the number of in a minute. And that was Warren Deck. You know, they are good friends. They worked together in the New York Philharmonic for so long. They taught together at Juilliard, and they respect each other a lot. So that Joe recommended me Warren instantly. And I worked with Warren for an entire year, you know, having a job in the Colorado Symphony, flying back and forth to Joe every 2 weeks, and pretty much every fifth or sixth day taking a lesson with Warren. You know, I was really, all the money I made, I put into lessons and music, basically. So
What did you most learn from Warren? How was that experience?
From Warren, I was really coached on the mental aspect of things, and he really helped me guide through those recitals. And I made sure that there was enough space between the recitals that we could work on the things that I didn't do well, mentally especially, things that I noticed I did wrong. Like, for example, the first recital, I went up there with a bottle of water, and then, you know, after the recital, I complained to Warren that my mouth got really dry and nothing really worked anymore. I didn't feel comfortable. So we explored that. You know, I started drinking vitamin water mixed. No, the first bottle was just vitamin water. the one with dragon fruit. I really liked that one. Mm-hmm. So I played the second recital with that, but then my mouth was it was just too sweet. There were too many electrolytes in my mouth. So then for the third one, we balanced it out with water, mix of that. So Warren was a coach, like an athlete would have a coach to figure out things that don't go as well. And not just, you know, the water bottles. That's just an example, but mentally and yeah, just so many things he really helped me.
There's going to be so many young trombonists going out and buying dragon fruit, vitamin water, and eating Chipotle before every audition.
It's like, oh, I'm so full, but Peter had two burritos in his audition, so I have to eat two burritos. So by the time you came to this recital, the 18-19 recital tour, or tours, I should say, did you feel confident about your recital playing at this point?
Yeah, at that point I felt comfortable. I had done so many concerts with the Vienna Philharmonic under high pressure, or so many solos in the ring, or, you know, in so many aspects, that I felt quite comfortable with my solo playing. I also recorded my first solo CD during the time, right there at the Vienna Philharmonic. And so I felt quite comfortable with solo playing. And then I just jumped on the opportunity and went for it. I made a killer program that I really enjoyed playing, pieces that I enjoyed playing, practicing, you know, programming already that I know that I have to play this piece over and over and over and over and over, practice it over and over. You need to choose pieces that you love. So it was just fun. And I set, you know, I purposely programmed certain pieces, for example, like Fly or Die, because mm-hmm. I didn't have a triple tongue at that point. I never needed triple tongue in my life. So I said, okay, if I don't learn it now, at some point I'm not going to have the energy to do it. So I just programmed that piece. And I did certain things to push my limits, to explore my musicality. And by the time the recital started, I felt quite comfortable. First tour was 17 recitals. Next tour was 55 recitals. And then there was a world tour, which was 30 recitals. So it just became second nature. Obviously, always having one constant thing, which her name says already, Constanze. That just makes life so much easier. You know, if I have a pianist that I can rely on, I can, it's just a sailing trip for me.
Oh yeah. Cause if you were showing up at every venue and it'd just be like, oh yeah, we have a pianist for you. I mean, that would just be insane.
Yeah.
So a nuts and bolts question, just how'd you go about planning and building the tour? I imagine it had so many emails and just personal contacts, and like, what was like your strategy to make it? First of all, you know, you're getting your name out there, which is awesome, but you know, you have to be able to make it financially viable. You know, being on the road is not cheap.
Yeah.
Where you stay, the travel costs and everything.
It was just kind of a dive in. Okay, let's do this. And then I was just basically sitting on the computer or behind the trombone all the time. My brain since then is always thinking about, let's call it work for now, but it's not work. It's my life. So my brain is constantly thinking about how to develop certain things. And that was definitely a lot of email work, still is every day. First, I started with the personal contacts, personal connections that I know, people that I know that I've played with, people that I've worked with, contacting those and seeing if there's opportunity to play with a wind band in their area, if there's opportunity to play a recital at their church, play a recital at their university. And then what I learned with the first tour was that things have to make sense and have to make sense geographically. For my first tour in the US, I flew from Pittsburgh to Miami and then back to Boston and then to Texas. It was just all over the place. It didn't make any sense geographically. So I got a little, you know, it was kind of learning by doing with the planning. But then I just started to always contact one person and then build a little tour around that. Then contact another person and build around the tour that, and then the tours got bigger and bigger and I connected them somehow. Of course, there was still a couple of times some ridiculous flying. I remember one time Constanze and I flew from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil via Ethiopia to Macau, to Hong Kong. And it was door to door, it was a 37-hour trip, and we performed at a recital at that night.
You went the wrong way. You should have gone the other way.
Yeah, it was just really really crazy. And we played the recital that night, and the audience was so amazing that we had to play three encores. I remember we were so done at the end, but still under so much adrenaline. But it was a lot of contacting, a lot of email, and a lot of learning by doing. Now we do things a lot differently. 4 years of doing this, we do much more driving, less flying. We have rest days in there where we also see the world. You know, in that year, we traveled everywhere, but we basically didn't see anything. We saw concert hall, we saw hotel, and students in between. But there was no exploration of, or no enjoyment of life, really. It was just going from one place to the other. And now, you know, the last tour we did, unfortunately, that we had to stop due to Corona, we got to see the Grand Canyon. We spent 2 days in LA. We got 2 days in Vegas, 2 days in San Francisco, you know, always in between concerts. But we saw something, and that was just really, really neat. And we're definitely, you know, continuing that planning process.
Yeah, I think I wonder if it was you were supposed to come and do like a master class at Juilliard pre-college.
Yeah.
And was that one of the first, that must have been one of the first cancellations for you?
Yeah, I think five venues left on the tour last year in March. And we flew back. We flew back from Denver with the last airplane coming to Europe. So
whoa.
Yeah, it was kind of strange, yeah. But
it must have been crazy, because I mean, you're the definition of, and it's so great to hear that you know, came to that realization already about, you know, yeah, it's really cool to be traveling and playing all the time, but if you're not enjoying it and present, yeah, and seeing these places, it's just like living in a room. So I mean, you were literally on the road for almost a year straight, and then you're faced with you have all this momentum in your career, and then you hit this unexpected thing where your life changes to the opposite. So I mean, how's that adjustment been?
Not so big for some reason, because we were on the road pretty much 3 years straight and never home longer than 3 weeks. It was just, that was like 1 year we were 9 months gone. And yeah, so it was weird coming home. I was kind of sad to come home, because I have all these crazy ideas in my mind of recording a lot of stuff and arranging and playing with this person, playing with that person. And just, I have so many ideas that I want to do. And as soon as, when I was in the US and I heard that Corona is starting in Europe, I was foolishly thinking that it would stay in Europe. And I planned already two recordings. I planned already two CDs to record, just because we would have to probably stay longer in the US. So it's just, it was a little weird to come home and kind of just hit the brake. But then again, it's just great. You know, Constanze is in the next room over there. We just kept going our own kind of path. We did so many still exciting things, even though we are playing into a computer. They are still meaningful to us. They still are part of our creativity. I had the time to finally write down my warm up. So that is also something I started doing. I've actually created my online trombone studio. I never would have thought that I, you know, would have students that are interested in hearing what I say. So now it's like 1 year that I have this program called Patreon, where there's, yeah, a lot of people interested in learning from me and playing with me. So I upload new play along videos every week. And so my practice has been really, really the main focus on all this, my practice and my private life. So it's, you know, Corona is not great and it's ruining the planet. But for me, in my safe space here, I'm trying to flourish as much as possible and being creative.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. Yeah, you really turned it into a positive. And I mean, you've really embraced we see you in a lot of places. You've really embraced the online world of whatever we can do with the trombone, or just figuring out new things that we can do. And there's so much creativity there. And what you're doing is great. Everything I've heard is fantastic. And my question for you is, with all this stuff that you're doing, and I know you love to play and you clearly are not afraid of the work, but does social media ever, every now and then, feel like an obligation? You know, are there ever moments where you're just like, okay, I need to make a post, I need to do this?
I think the hardest thing for me was to start with. I was really late on Instagram. I started it last year. Like by now it's a year and a half. I started it on, I think, around New Year's of 2019 into 20. So I was really late to that. I only had Facebook before, and I was a little closed-minded about the entire online community. Also YouTube, I kind of neglected all the time. Foolishly, I let other people post all my good videos. And so, you know, I never really thought that there would be one day where the focus will be on that. Like if you compare that to Christopher Bill, for example, I mean, he's all on YouTube, and there you can see that there's a possibility to make money of it. But I never thought that would be, yeah, it just never really crossed my mind that I would go that route, or I would have to go that route in order to pay rent. So I think the hardest thing for me was to start letting people into my private life, to start doing stories. You know, first you start with pictures. It always kind of feels like a self-presentation, which I'm not so, it's not the greatest thing. I like to let other people talk about me rather than myself talk about myself. That's not so interesting. I would much rather hear you, Sebastian, or Nick talk right now. So
it's you're in like, the wrong place.
Yeah.
Well, I've listened to all the other podcasts, so I'm happy. I'm in a happy place. I've heard all your stories. Oh, I have to open some brackets. Nick, Panda Express is good.
What?
You said it was bad. In the interview with Marcus, you said Panda Express. You downgraded Panda Express.
Can't be hating on the panda, man.
No hate on the panda.
I will die on this hill. That is garbage food.
And Euphonium is a nice instrument, guys. They sound beautiful.
Well, it's all nice to meet you, Peter. Thanks for coming on.
Good luck with your life, Peter. This is not a safe space for Euphonium.
No, it's become this like, I mean, we totally feel fine about the Euphonium, but it's just become this like ongoing inside joke where, yeah, we need to find a way to like rail against the Euphonium in every episode. It's like, make it happen.
Sorry, where were we?
No, well, yeah. So, I mean, you've embraced this thing and so how do you, because obviously we know how it can help and how it can be important and engaging with our followers and everything, but how do you find balance where it still feels fun? Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like you're being too personal, but it's also helping.
Yeah, I think a right balance of giving them not just, you know, professional life. I try to stay really professional and give them my warm up and focus on this and that and kind of influence the community that way, or occasionally show my playing, just, you know, a video of me playing. But then there also needs to be enough so that they can relate to you, that you're also just a normal human being. So you're not just completely just a workaholic. And, you know, which I am. I enjoy life. I really try to be as happy as possible all the time. And that means enjoying life. So letting them in, I think the right balance is, you know, you just have to find how, you know, the balance of what you feel comfortable, you know, posting. I see so many people that post 20 stories every day. It's just too much for me. I even don't have that many events a day that I feel like, oh, I need to show them this now. Sometimes things I don't show them might be interesting to the community, but yeah, just however I feel, you know, I don't see it as work. I see it as a representation of how I feel in that moment. If I feel like putting a story up there, I do it. And if there's a day where I'm just practicing and in a happy place with that, and I like to get my pizza and not share it at night, those days happen as well. It's what is tricky, and now with more and more followers, it's always making them happy. That's a little bit, seems like you always need to kind of make them happy. Well, you know, I'm showing you my life. I don't have to, there's no obligation of me making you happy.
Exactly. Like you need to be happy first. Yeah. Otherwise you're missing the point, right?
So that's a little bit tricky, but overall, it's a part of what I do, and no, it's good. I enjoy it. I also enjoy, you know, meeting new people, interacting with them, and seeing that people enjoy what I do. I mean, it's really nice. It's like an applause at the end of a concert. If you get new followers, like the Paganini video I posted, I think that boosted it by 1,500 followers. That's really nice. You know, it's like, oh, people are actually seeing this. It's like if you get booked for many concerts, you see that people want to hear you. And so I enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I just have a couple more questions and then we can move on. And And definitely, and follow Pete on his, what's your Instagram again? Is it
Peter Steiner Official?
Peter Steiner Official. And you can see all his great shots with his bedroom eyes. Yep, you have a lot of good new ones. And some great trombone playing, of course, too.
By the way, yeah. That too.
By the way. But, I mean, you got to give the ladies what they want sometimes. And the guys.
And the gentlemen.
And the guys. A few questions I wrote down for you. You know, we've seen trombone soloists become full-time trombone soloists. We're not anywhere near the amount of, you know, full-time violin soloists, full-time piano soloists. Do you think there's a place for more full-time trombone soloists, following in the line of Christian Lindbergh, for example?
I think there's Christian has definitely opened doors for our generation. I think, and not just Christian, you know, Michel Becquet, Joe, Alain Trudel, Branimir Slokar, they really pushed the boundaries and they gave the instrument attention. And, you know, people like Jürgen van der Rijn are really, you know, clearing the path of what's possible. And I think there is definitely room for trombone and brass soloists. The problem I see is that, I mean, this might sound really offensive to many people, but being a principal trombonist is a different role than a soloist. And principal trombonists like to get into the role of the soloist and often might not be the best advertisement for the instrument, if I may say that.
Hot take.
It's the same as concert masters don't play solos. You know, they occasionally get the opportunity, but there's violin soloists coming in that it's their job and they're good at it. And you know, they respect that. Same with principal cellists. You know, there's cellists coming in, a soloist, and the principal is happy that there's a soloist coming. They're not threatened by the fact that there's a soloist there. I think,
but often because there's you know, it's so rare that they program a trombone concerto. Usually, the principal in the orchestra is going to try to play it.
Yeah, I don't blame them, but it's just I think that's an issue, and that's. I think managements just need to jump more often on the opportunity of having a trombone soloist. I think that way the principal trombonist will be happy and also the soloist will be happy. There's plenty of good pieces out there and plenty of amazing players that can represent the instrument really well. And, you know, the managements and orchestras just don't see the instrument as the most, they don't see it as we see it. So we just need to show them that that's possible. You know, certain things they just, so many people that have heard that Paganini never would have thought that that would be possible on a trombone. Well, you know, if you listen to CDs by Joe Alessi or by all of these guys, you know that the Paganini is possible. So, but as a violinist, you're not aware of that. So I think that's where the problem lies at. But I see the our generation, there's already so many amazing trombone soloists that are establishing themselves that I think in the next 10 to 15 years, I think there will be more programming for trombonists.
I hope so. I think it'd be interesting.
And how much of a role do you think getting new established works will help too? Because, I mean, we're also fighting the fact that pianist and violinist and cellist have just such a more vast repertoire.
They definitely have a more vast repertoire, but I think we trombonists or especially trombonists, we downgrade our works by a lot. Yes, we have pieces by Leopold Mozart, by Albrechtsberger. The David Concerto is beautiful with orchestra. You know, orchestra musicians enjoy listening to that. It's just that we have, you know, we have kind of downgraded it so far down that we don't enjoy it anymore. So, yes, new works are important, but I think they also need to showcase the pretty aspects of trombone, which the new works sometimes they go so far out there that the curious people that want to listen to that is a really small amount of listeners. So I think we first need to reach the people that are generally interested in classical music, people that listen to Beethoven sonatas, people that enjoy the Brahms violin concerto. They're going to have a hard time with the Rauch trombone concerto, unfortunately. There's a big gap between the Bach violin, the Brahms violin concerto and then the Rauch. You know, we kind of need to feel, I feel like, and that's what I'm trying to do in my recitals. I always try to give the listener, people that are not trombonists, I try to show them how pretty the trombone can sound and what just kind of elegance we can also bring to the table. I think of the trombone as the cello in the brass world. So, you know, we should try to play as pretty as a cello and not, yeah, it's just a little bit frustrating sometimes. If an entire concerto consists of glissandi, a violin can do glissandi, but do they do it all the time?
That's a good point.
So
no, I mean, yeah, that's, I think that's something Yo-Yo Ma does so well is because he can do all the crazy stuff too, but he knows he needs to find the audience first or meet them maybe halfway.
Yeah.
And then take them there or put out a few albums there, explore a little bit more. Because, I mean, the perception of the trombone to the common person, I had management with a chamber group I used to have, and we'd get questions back all the time about when we submitted, like, our proposals. They're like, oh, four trombones. Like, can you guys play soft? Like, do you guys have any lyrics? Because they're just scared.
Are you going to march in front of us?
Yeah. So, like, to get a arts organization to trust you enough to program a piece, they have to know that there's some level of audience like engagement there.
Yeah. So I think there's good pieces that we should play more often. And yes, we also, I don't want to downgrade the Rouse Concerto, please, listeners, don't get me wrong, but we need more of that music as well. But I think we need to find the right balance. And first of all, get the attention of the audience. And the attention of the audience, especially in the world we live in now with TikTok and all these pop stars, might not be always the route that we classical musicians envision. Just, you know, to broaden the mind, I think we need to get for it. We need first to get the attention before we try to be super special.
Cool. So, all right, I just have a couple more questions and Nick has a question. So speaking of like solo pieces, and I'm kind of changing it based on what we're just talking about, say and maybe it depends on the orchestra for you, but say a major orchestra wants you to be a soloist next year, and it's going to be a really big audience, and it's going to be something that, you know, you want to just show this audience what the trombone can do, and kind of along the lines of what you're saying, what piece would you choose?
That's a tricky question.
You could choose anything you want.
Anything I want. I have never played the piece, so I don't know what the reward of the audience would be afterwards, but I really enjoy the concerto by Frumeri. Mm-hmm. Una de Frumeri, it's originally composed for cello, so maybe that's why I like it. It's really written for a cello. It sounds like cello music, and it's just super lyrical, super pretty. Hard, really hard, technically hard, range-wise, a lot of high Fs and just taxing on your chops. And so I've never played it because it's also quite long. I think it's 27 minutes and orchestras tend to not go with that. But if I would choose, I would probably go with that because that way I could really show the lyrical aspect of trombone playing.
Awesome. Very cool. Great piece for those listening if you haven't heard that before. Last one for me. What's something people might be surprised to know about you?
I might not look like it anymore, but I was a professional athlete one day.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was a goalkeeper in handball. It doesn't really exist in the U.S., but it's actually an Olympic sport.
Yeah.
And I played with my hometown team, and we actually won the national championship, and I was part of the national team. So I was shortly before choosing that career, but then I went with trombone.
Very cool.
Wow. And we should clarify for our American audience, because we have a sport called handball that's close to like racquetball, but you play with your hand.
Oh.
Like you hit like a small ball with your hand against a wall.
Oh, I see.
So it's like squash or racquetball. So this is a different game. It's closer to soccer, but you throw the ball.
It's basically like basketball rules with harder tackling, but you have to not score a basket, but a goal.
Yeah. It's
mixed. Oh, there's tackling.
Yeah, there's a lot of tackling. There's a lot of injuries. Oh. I was goalkeeper. I was the dumb one that people shot at. So my friends always made, you know, games during practice, you know, who could shoot my face. And yeah,
yep.
That explains the nose.
Oh, so there's a question I usually ask every guest, but I'd like to change it up a little bit for you. Since, you know, one thing that goes along with your recital tour that you did with Constanza, or the recital tours that you've done with Constanza, are masterclasses. So I know you've heard lots of students all over the world. Mm-hmm. What's one thing that they need to spend more time doing when it comes to practice?
Work and think about sound. You know, if there's no good sound, nobody will pay for listening to you. That's just the simplest explanation. If Beyoncé has a bad day and sounds bad, people are not enjoying her concert. But if she sounds good, her voice is well-rounded on that day, it's just a joy. It's the same with us, you know. If somebody can play the craziest technical things, but the sound is not good, it's just not enjoyable to me personally. So I think oftentimes we focus on, you know, who can play the loudest, who can play the fastest, who can play the lowest and highest, but we don't focus on, you know, can you just play one pretty note? You know, nobody wants to hear a perfect bolero if the sound is shitty. So I think just focusing on playing with a good sound.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a baiting question because I remember the masterclass you gave at Manus when you were here, and you said something like, you know, I've given so many masterclasses and I've heard so many students, and rarely have I heard people that have both a great sound and great technique. And you said like the sound was usually the thing missing. And it was a harsh reality that you put out there. It's like, hey, we got to focus on sound, you know?
Yeah, it's the simplest thing.
It's true.
It's so simple, and we always seem to skip it. We want to achieve fast flexibility. We want to achieve a good tongue. We want to achieve, you know, replicating notes. But again, if you replicate them and they just don't sound good, who really cares?
Mm. I like that. I do, personally. I mean, it's a hard truth, but it's we live in the world of creating sound.
And you know, I face it too. You know, I'm in a practice room and I practice something for 20 minutes and then I stop and I'm like, man, that just really sounded horrible. Why are you doing that? You know, it gets out of hand really easily. We can lose focus on that quite easily for some reason. We overstep that step of, you know, does it actually sound good? And sometimes, you know, when my chops are not feeling great, or I go from one recital to the other and I'm having a harder time one day, sometimes I don't find my sounds until the second or third piece, because, you know, I do my warm up, but it's just a constant development and exploration. You might wake up with the worst sound and by the end of your warm up, it's refined. So it's not a given. It's not that, you know, every time I pick up my horn and it's golden. No, sometimes it's really, really dark.
Speaking of sound, I spent a little time listening to your New Planets recording today, and I encourage everyone to check that out. And just the way it was recorded alone, besides your great playing, the way it was recorded was just really fantastic, I thought.
Good. I'm glad. It's about to, the entire album is about to drop in pretty much 4 weeks. So we have 3 more singles coming out, a couple of videos coming out now as well, and then in a month the full album drops. So it's really exciting.
I heard it's out of this world.
Hey,
gotta have at least one dad joke every podcast. Well, man, it's really, really awesome to hang out with you, and really, I really enjoyed hearing everything you had to say, and I really look forward to having some Panda Express with you in the future.
Well, thank you for having me. I was super, super happy when you guys contacted me. As I said, I've listened to all the other podcasts and I'm a big fan of you both and of the retreat, of the podcast. So I'm just really, really happy to be spending an hour with you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great to talk to you and hear a little bit more about your story. And, you know, I look forward to hearing another recital of yours when we're back in normal times, whatever that means.
We are planning a crazy new program. So it should be fun.
Okay, cool.
Awesome. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. All right. Hey, say hi to Constanza for me.
Will do. Yeah, you as well to everybody. I know you guys.
Sure, absolutely.
awesome to have on the Italian Stallion, Peter Steiner.
He should put that on his bio.
Absolutely.
First time for me to meet him. Impressive young man. Can I call him a young man? I'm barely older than him.
Young whippersnapper.
But he's really determined, and he's the path he's chosen, you know, going after the solo career, it's not an easy one, but you got to have the mindset he has to go after. And I'm excited to watch his career unfold in the future.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's already done so much. I mean, between all the recitals he's given all over the world and getting to the finals of the Tchaikovsky competition, the first ever brass iteration of the Tchaikovsky competition. I mean, that's a huge, I mean, he's done so much. And, you know, one thing I wanted to talk about, I didn't want to go into in the intro or in the interview itself, is Peter, to put all this together, it's not like it just falls into his lap. Like it's the, especially the recital tours, that's kind of what I'm talking about. The last recital tour he did before the pandemic hit included recital and masterclass at Manus, which I facilitated. And, you know, I mean, it's not like I wasn't looking to have Peter Steiner come, but he reached out to me and said, hey, we're going to be on in the area around this time. Is there any way we can make something work? And so he reached out to me and made it happen, essentially, you know, because a lot of it is just letting people know, hey, I'm going to be around these times. Can we make something work? And I think there's a lot to be learned outside of being a soloist, just being a musician, of, you know, there is an element of having to create your own work, be it teaching or freelancing or whatnot. You got to reach out to people and let them know that you're around. So I just really, am inspired by his hustle and his determination to get out there and make things happen.
Yeah. And as good a player as he is, I mean, it's what we talk about all the time. You don't just assume people just call you and offer you things.
Yeah,
of course. You can be good and be proactive, and it's not selling yourself short. It's actually smart. And one thing I wanted to expound on, he was talking about at the end, I asked him about, I really wanted to get his take on the future of trombone soloists and how we could see more. It was a really interesting answer he had, and he was a little nervous to say it, but I think he has a point, and I see it on both sides of trombone concertos with an orchestra, for example. We're just talking about that place, is not programmed a ton, right? First of all, we don't have a ton of repertoire. The audience is a little hesitant. People are a little hesitant to program it sometimes. It usually goes well. And so when that happens, obviously, it typically will be the principal in the orchestra that will play it, you know? That saves money for the orchestra, most likely. It's a way to promote your own players. Great. There's often really great players in these orchestras. So it makes sense. But at the same time, if there's this whole league of trombone soloists trying to make a career, that might cut off opportunities where you see violinists, cellists, this being a very normal thing.
One of the biggest aspects I think that he's touching upon is if we had more trombone music, trombone soloists, then there would be room for kind of everybody. There would be room for the soloists. There'd be room for the principals in the orchestra to have a chance too, because, you know, there's more programming of trombone concertos. And, you know, I think that's kind of the point he was making. And I agree. I mean, I think that would be cool. I never understood the obsession with just like, all right, let's have a piano soloist or a violin soloist, and let's get really weird sometimes and have a cello soloist. It's like, you know, why don't we have more trumpet soloists? Why don't we have more horn? Why don't we have more bassoon, whatever, you know, just to keep it varied, you know?
Yeah, so it's like we kind of just need more quantity of opportunities and get to a point eventually where it's not strange and it's not an ego check if, you know, a great trombone soloist comes to play with your orchestra and someone that's focused on that life and it's going to do a great job and raise the profile of the instrument. That's not the craziest thing, but I think we need it to happen more often for that to be normal. And of course, I want more principals or just members of the orchestra have more solo opportunities.
Sure.
For sure.
Absolutely.
So it's an interesting topic to bring up. A couple things from that I want to talk about, because we're a trombone podcast. We want to serve the community. We want to give ideas. I love talking to trombonists who have just done the job for a long time, and you're always going to learn something from another person, young or old. But Phil McClelland, who is the bass trombonist of the Harrisburg Symphony, who's a great guy, was actually at Curtis with Joe, their roommates. He's got a lot of stories about Joe. and I've been playing with Harrisburg for the last few years. And he had this idea for mutes. He's like, because I always have trouble, either the mute's like too squeaky or it takes forever to get out. And he's like, you know, you usually do the thing where you like spray it with water, or you lick the cork, or you do the on your bell, you know. And he's like, the night before, rub Vaseline on it, on all the corks. Just a little bit of Vaseline, let it sink in. It absorbs moisture. It keeps the cork soft. And I did that and it changed my life. You can just put it straight in, straight out. You don't have to do the twist. It'll stay. It's sticky enough. There's no squeak.
Can we refer to that going forward to the McClellan method?
The McClellan method.
Say that five times fast.
So thank you, Phil McClelland. I just wanted to add that little trombone hack.
Yeah, this week's trombone hack.
Another thing that I've been thinking about with this opera we just finished was, especially because, you know, since we've been away from playing consistently, is how much we joke about counting rests, you know? And it hit me once I was back playing that rests are meditation. It's literally a form of meditation. You're away from distractions. You're focused on a singular thing. It's very repetitive. You're hearing beautiful music in the background, hopefully. And I found it just lowered all anxiety level. It made me feel really nice. And it's like one little oasis that I have in life where I'm not distracted by something or wanting to look at my phone. And it's actually a beautiful thing. And as trombonists, we uniquely get to count more rests than most people.
That's a really good way to positively spin mundane activity.
And I'm a big meditation guy, you know. I don't know. It hit me. And it's just like now I'm valuing getting to be in a rehearsal and just sitting there silently. And
I'll have to absorb that next time I'm counting 600 bars of rest.
It's important. So we had a really thoughtful question written in, a comment on our iTunes. Thank you for the 5-star review. And I just wanted to read this to you, Nick, and see your thoughts on it. So this is from Bent Trombone. It's a good name. Mm-hmm. Subject, thank you. I recently really struggled with motivation, drive, and even some bouts with depression for the first time in my life. I got to a point where I was ready to give up caring about the trombone. Then one day I decided to listen to the Trombone Retreat podcast, knowing next to nothing about it. I've been binging every episode for the past 3 weeks. Thank you. The relationship that Nick and Sebastian have and their passion for trombone and fostering relationships has been a giant factor in helping me pull out of the slump that I've been in. This podcast has helped inspire me, motivate me, and reignited my passion for playing the trombone. Sincerely, thank you for everything you guys do. Never underestimate the impact of a positive attitude and a friendly demeanor. And obviously that means a lot to us. I almost don't know what to say. And so he asks at the end, can you all talk about your own struggles with motivation and mental health, especially through the pandemic? Thanks again, guys.
Okay. I mean, this is, how do you say it? On the nose for a lot of people right now. I mean, I think it's on the nose for people in general, but like, especially during this really crazy time, because, you know, we don't have any resources to like look at and be like, oh, this is how people have dealt with this situation in the past. I mean, really, this situation is completely a new path for everybody. It's a path we don't want to be on, but we're on, you know, dealing with the pandemic. And it's still going on, you know, and it's crazy. So get vaccinated. But, oh, the motivation thing, the depression thing, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, and we could have a whole episode about that. So the motivation thing, that has been a serious factor for myself, but you know, it's, you're not alone in that. I teach a lot, and a lot of my students, you know, they'll have bouts of motivation met with bouts of just huge slumps, like you're talking about. And those periods vary from like, oh, I just don't feel like playing today, I'll play tomorrow, to like, oh, I don't feel like playing this month, maybe I'll play next month. And, you know, if you're a student, that's much harder to get away with because you have obligations, be it chamber music or orchestra or lessons or whatnot. But, you know, I know professionals that haven't played since the pandemic began. And it started as, oh, this will be a nice break. I mean, when we thought it was going to be like a month long, to I just can't imagine picking it up right now. And You know, I think there's that, and then there's the other side, which is I'm going to practice every single day because I want to get better through this time. And I think both are legit and both are totally acceptable. It just, it depends on how you're handling it. And that ties into the mental health thing. I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that a lot of people are suffering from anxiety and depression during this time, myself included. And, you know, I mean, the number one thing I would suggest is find resources that help you, be it, you know, the most obvious one, mental health professionals, because they do this for a living, and get some coping mechanisms, be it talk therapy, be it meditation, be it some sort of routine in your life, workout or cooking or something like that, that there's something on your calendar every day that come hell or high water, I'm going to do this routine. I'm going to cook my eggs for breakfast. I'm going to go for this 20-minute walk, whatever it is. For me, you know, actually, like, we got a dog 6 months ago, and the routine of having a dog has been so helpful on days that I'm feeling really low, because, you know, the dog is going to have to go outside or it's going to pee all over my place, you know? So every couple hours, I got to get up no matter what and go do that. And it's been nice because, be it back in Michigan where we got him, or, you know, we were in New York, taking him on walks, exploring the neighborhood, meeting other pups, you know, that sort of thing has kind of broke me out of my slump. And kind of like things like that, I'm talking about things completely away from the trombone at the moment, but those things can bring you back to the trombone because you have this one little thing that's a routine. You have this one little routine, and then from there, it's like you get back from your walk and you feel just energized, and you say, oh, well, maybe I'll pick up the trombone, or, you know, maybe I'll listen to this symphony or something like that. And I think it kind of feeds on itself when you just kind of force yourself to take that first step. So, you know, I think it's okay to feel down for sure. But like, if it becomes like a long-term thing, you should try to actively do something to break yourself out of a slump.
Yeah, I think that's a key thing. It's like, yes, it's okay to feel this way. And that's the first step, is like, you have to accept that it's okay. All these feelings, sure. Like self-guilt and everything. But sometimes, yeah, we have to find ways to snap ourselves out of it a little bit and break through. And my big thing this pandemic has been realizing the value of consistency, even over quantity of practice. Just like doing a little bit every day can be so much more valuable than trying to do a ton one day and then not playing for a week. And yeah, so, I mean, thank you for your question. And it's just so meaningful. And, you know, for professionals, you know, and students, we've been thrown out of our routines. And for a lot of us, the routines is what kept us sane. And maybe it was a band-aid over real problems, and taking away that distraction got in the way. And, you know, as far as playing, a lot of us professionals stay in shape by just being busy all the time.
Yep.
And we have to go back when we were a little younger and having to practice all the time and having that self-discipline on our own. And for some people, their coping mechanism is playing every day.
Right.
You know?
For sure.
So it... First of all, forgive yourself, but at the same time, you know, sometimes you got to fight through something and just start, even if it's just like 5 minutes, fight through it. We're honored that our podcast has played a small role in helping you.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's definitely helped us.
I think. It's funny. Yeah, that's one of the first things that popped in my head is, you know, we've gotten messages like privately that are similar to this, but it's funny that sometimes I'll be in a slump and we'll talk to someone, and really any of our guests, and there'll be a motivation or an idea that they have, and it makes me want to go to the trombone or make me want to listen to music, and it brings me back. So it's like, it helps us too, for sure. It's not just helping others, which is great, we're helping others, but it helps us as well.
And sometimes, like, we feel all these things too. Sometimes Nick and I will wake up and we have a scheduled interview or we have a scheduled recording, and we're just like, you know, I had a tough night last night, or having a tough morning this morning. Is it okay if we just push it back a little bit? And we're always like, absolutely.
You know?
Because we got to build this around us and not force it. And we want to be our best selves for you guys as much as we can, and for the great people we're interviewing. So again, thank you for the comment. I hope that adds a little clarity. But yeah, you're not alone. And just, you know, be present. Every day is a new day to do your best.
Yeah.
So if you enjoyed the podcast, please consider leaving us a rating and review on iTunes. If you want to leave a question or topic you'd like us to discuss, we may answer it on the podcast. Follow us at Trombone Retreat on Facebook, Instagram, the YouTubes, the FaceTubes, the Tweet Machines, and our website, tromboneretreat.com, where you can also join our mailing list. Also, feel free to shoot us an email at tromboneretreat@gmail.com, as we love hearing from you. On the Instagrams, Instagrizzles, follow Nick at BassTrombone444. Three fours, not four fours, three fours, mm-hmm. 444. And myself at js.vera. And as always, never forget.
When the times they get hard, make yourself a ham sammy.
Go on, retreat yourself.